Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller for a few days on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. We're going to be talking about the insect kingdom with Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. Phil, it's always a pleasure to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Nice to be here, Jim.
And now that the emerald ash borer has finally been found in southeastern Wisconsin, what's next? I must say that I saw you on the television talking about this when the discovery was made of the borer, and you said that in Michigan it had been 10 years that they'd had an experience and didn't know it.
Right. It's going to take a little time, I think, to get a real handle on how big this infestation is, and then we kind of adjust. But I at least don't expect in the short run. I think the comparison has been made to Dutch elm disease, and there's some reasons to believe that 100 years from now, indeed, it may look what Dutch elm disease did to elms ash in a similar fashion. But I think we're also hopeful that if we can keep these infestations small, be aggressive at managing them, that the spread will be much slower. And so that's, I think, where we're sitting right now is assessing how big it is. And then once we get a good handle on that, maybe get a little bit better handle on how quickly it will spread. Through a combination of sanitation for high-value trees. There are some insecticide treatments that can be done. I think what's still the scariest scenario for all of us is if it comes in through the UP, because then it would be so hard to manage in natural settings and whatnot. And so at least in these urban settings, we have more chance to make an impact, I guess.
All right. And if you'd like to join the conversation, a couple of lines are filling right now. In Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. How would you characterize this year's gypsy moth caterpillar populations?
Well, it's been building for the last 3 or 4 years, and it was late in coming, just the way the weather had went. But the thing that was very encouraging to me is back when it got very wet for a good portion of the state in June, that really kicked up the amount of entomophaga fungus disease. Very reminiscent to what we saw in 2004, where we had this 2-week wet period and a high percentage of the caterpillars got sick. And so I was anticipating in a lot of sites, including Madison, a lot more trees to be totally stripped out. And we didn't get that call. Had some great pictures sent to me. The people had hundreds of dead caterpillars on the trunks of trees. And so I think when we get all the moth catches in the Department of Ag does and gets those counts up, we're going to see a drop in the population. How much of a drop, again, I'm not quite sure. And we've always talked about this, is if we can get this kind of weather pattern once every 3 or 4 years, it puts the lid on those populations and prevents these explosions. So I really was at first thinking we missed that opportunity, because usually it's more in May that we get that wet period that we see the big impact. But this year it was June. And again, from everything I've seen in general, it really did knock that population down.
Phil Pelletieri is our guest. Let's go to the phones, take some calls. And Susan in Oregon is first. Hello, Susan.
Hi. I have a caterpillar that I was hoping maybe you could identify. And now I'm kind of concerned from your introduction there that it could be that gypsy moth caterpillar. It's on my milkweed, and I had planted, I let milkweed grow in my yard so that I could attract the monarch butterflies. But now I've got a bunch of these little caterpillars that are fluffy. Mm-hmm. They're black, and they have these kind of white wisps coming out of them, and then sure. They've got some kind of orange gold on the back.
The animal is called a milkweed tussock moth. And tussock moths are always kind of hairy and have these little what we call pencil hairs. They're almost like bristles that stick out from them. They're exclusive to milkweed. You will always find them in colonies, though. You never find single caterpillars. But other than that, because they only feed on milkweed, they're really not an issue. The other thing about gypsy moth, we're well past the caterpillar stage. That's basically a May and June thing. And at this stage, even there may be a few adults around, but most of the gypsy moths are in an egg stage that will not hatch until next spring.
Okay, what does a gypsy moth look like?
Well, the most distinctive thing when the caterpillars get bigger, they are somewhat hairy, but not near as hairy as this tussock moth that you have. And they have 5 pairs of blue dots followed by 6 pairs of reddish dots along the back. And so it's each abdominal segment has one of these pairs of dots, and you see this transition. And when they're full grown, the females are upwards of about 2.5 inches in length. So they're a pretty good-sized caterpillar.
Moth, what should I do with them? Can I just let them go, or should I start destroying them?
No, you can let them go. I mean, you could argue that they're competing with monarchs, but they've always competed with monarchs. These are both native insects, and so, as I said, it's just another insect that's utilizing milkweed as a food source.
Okay. Well, great. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. And what do you hear about the monarch population this summer?
Well, more from just my personal observations, I think I saw my first monarch in probably about the 20th of May, give or take a couple days, which is normal, maybe a smidgen early. I think a lot of butterflies had a tough time with the rains, and so we didn't see much of a flush with that first generation, but things have kind of been picking up, and we're probably about 3 weeks away or so from the monarch starting to migrate through. Then I think we'll get a better assessment of what it is. So I've seen them rebound a bit. As I said, in June, in general, I thought they were down quite a bit.
Phil Pelletieri is our guest as we go to Marilyn in Superior next. Hello, Marilyn. What's on your mind today?
Well, Phil has given us some information about getting rid of crickets. We had them infest inside the house. Not that bad, but, 10 or something up to a 10 a day. And I can't remember what kind of a chemical he said to spray around the perimeter of the house.
Well, what you will find is almost any of the products that are normally used for ant control in those situations, most of them are synthetic pyrethroids like permethrin and bifenthrin and lambda cy halothrin, and they all perform in a similar manner. They have quick knockdown. They have some repellency to them. And so really, in the olden days, we used to use malathione, which was relatively non-toxic, but it was kind of smelly and also a little tough on plants. The newer products don't have those dilemmas. They're similar to malathione and being less toxic to people, and will hold up for 2 to 3 weeks in most cases. And again, the whole idea is to set the line in the sand and kill them before they get in. It's much easier dealing with them there.
Mm-hmm. So you would just spray something around the edge of the house?
Yeah, well, typically, if you were to call a commercial person, there's a definition of what's called a barrier treatment, and it's basically from the foundation out anywhere from 2 to as much as 10 feet. I don't think you have to go a full 10 feet, but it'd be worth putting a 2 or 3 foot wide spray, and then going from the foundation up maybe anywhere from 6 inches to 2 feet. The other thing, though, to look at in most houses for a lot of this stuff, earwigs and all these other little critters that are kind of coming in by accident, is if you look where your siding meets the foundation, there's often a spacing. You don't leak air, so your house can be energy efficient, but if an insect can crawl up and through there, then they can weasel around in the walls and end up falling down into your basement. And so a lot of times going and tightening that up by using expanding foam or other products is the best solution in the long run, because it really prevents things long term from getting in the house. And the problem with the sprays is they're temporary. You're setting up a barrier, and over a period of time they break down, and either you have to reapply them, or every year you'll have to reapply them at minimum. And so, as I said, one thing to look at is to see if you can physically build them out better than you can with sprays.
Okay, that sounds like a good idea, but the sprays would not damage any gardens or anything like that we have?
Well, you always have to read the label to tell you what you can use. Many of the products I had mentioned have labels for vegetables and the like. But in particular, other than if you had tomatoes growing right next to the house, most of your plants are probably ornamental, and there definitely won't be a problem there. And again, I can't overemphasize the reading of the label, because I get this call every year of people who don't. They have stuff in the sprayer, and then they decide, I might as well spray my tomatoes, and then I get the call, and they put something on that's not registered, and aside from not being legal, that's just not a healthy thing to do.
Mm-hmm. All right, Marilyn, thanks very much. Appreciate hearing from you. If you'd like to join in, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller, as we talk with Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. Brittany DeAnda is our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard with you. Glad to have you along as we talk about bugs and insects today with Phil Pelletieri. And let's go back to the phones to Frank in Helenville next. And Frank, go ahead.
Yes, my question is not so much about any type of bug, but I'm out in the field a lot. We raise sheep, and we do a lot of grazing and cross-fencing, and we're out there, and the mosquitoes are very bad. I don't care to spray with any insect repellent, and I was wondering what type of clothing would Phil be wearing when he's outside a lot, and did he... Somebody told me that there is something out like a bug shirt, and I was wondering if you ever heard of it or had worn it, or if he would rate it somehow, or sure. if he could tell me anything about it.
Well, two things. There are these mesh suits that they sell, and it's a very fine mesh, very much like you'd have on a tent screen. And when I get into really nasty mosquitoes, I have one of these little suits. I don't wear the pants very often, but usually the jacket, and it has a hood that goes over it. And it works very well because the mosquitoes can't get to you. And it's not there's no chemicals to it. It's just a physical way of protecting. You can wear a T-shirt underneath it. So, again, in the summer, they're still reasonably comfortable. The Army had worked for quite some time because of people in the tropics in particular exposed to ticks and mosquitoes and no-see-ums and the like. And they have basically come up with a form of clothing that has the insecticide impregnated into it. And typically it's permethrin, which is a very common insecticide. It's the same spray that we put on our clothing to repel ticks and the like. But they have put it in such a way that it can go through washings. And so for people that spend a lot of time outdoors, that is one possibility. I've never owned a shirt, but my wife was nice enough to get me a hat with this permethrin impregnated in it. I really was quite impressed. Now, what's interesting is permethrin has some repellency, and so it does keep them off. But technically, if the mosquito is silly enough to land on it, it can be exposed to enough permethrin that it's at least knocked out, if not killed. So you're kind of getting two things at once, both the repellency and the knockdown associated with it. And so far, I really have been very pleased with it. I haven't washed the hat yet. So that's another option. But the difference there is you will have chemical that's on the clothing, whereas, again, just these bug-out and bug-off type suits are more a physical way of, and they're small enough that you can usually, fold them up in your pocket quite easily when you're, out backpacking, those kind of things.
You think you could find that then, on the internet or something?
Yes, definitely a lot of sporting goods companies tend to have it because people that, hunters and whatnot use a lot of this stuff. Cabela's, I think L.L. Bean at one time or another, I don't know if they still have it in their catalog. And I'm sure other companies that specialize in outdoor clothing. I've seen three or four different brands. There was one Bug Off outerwear that was manufactured and I think still is out of Milwaukee area. And then there are other companies that have gotten into it. I think Remington is another brand I've seen of these suits.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, Frank, good luck to you. Thanks very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you this morning. And on to Charlie in Fish Creek. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, good morning. Say, Phil, over the last couple of years, I've noticed we've had these black widow spiders nesting in the front of our house. I live in a wooded area. And the first year, we captured one in a jar, and 2 days later, there was a nice little round egg sac in there. Mm-hmm. And this year, there was probably three females that I had found. And I just sprayed them with insecticide spider killer, and I killed them. But what are the chances of them coming back? How dangerous are they? And how can I treat the area without killing the rest of the beneficial spiders?
Right. Well, it's interesting because we've been well aware that black widow spiders, the northern black widow, is native to Wisconsin. But I will tell you, in my whole career, I've only seen it a handful of times come in the lab. I do see some of the other widow spiders coming in on produce, on grapes and whatnot. But the widow that is native to Wisconsin it's such a secretive spider. If I had to go look for it, to be honest, I would go to find an area with rock piles and similar kind of debris and go digging in there. It's not a spider that comes out in the open very much. And with that also, I will tell you that I am not aware in my career of anybody who was bit that had to go to the hospital with a black widow. It's probably happened, but it has not been brought to my attention, which tells me it doesn't happen very often. How dangerous? It's a very painful experience. A lot of stomach and abdominal cramping is typically associated with it. It is not life-threatening in most cases unless people have other compromised health issues to deal with. And again, they are very secretive, and so you have to kind of go looking for them. They're not coming to look for you. So one of the things I guess you may consider, if it was really a bother, I think it would be more to look at habitat changing. I don't know if you want to go this direction, but, you don't see black widows in a typical lawn. They're just not the hiding places. The more rock walls and debris and that kind of stuff that's around is the kind of habitat they would like. Much as indoors, typically you find them in attics and in other, quiet, out-of-the-way spaces. They're just not something that likes to get out in the open. So that would be one thing to consider, is making some adjustment, getting a little bit more light, a little bit more air in there, and that may make a habitat that you don't see them. And I will tell you, the numbers you're seeing are moderately impressive, because, as I said, most people... if I told them to go find a black widow and gave them all summer, I'd be surprised if they found one.
Well, it was the first time in my life I'd ever seen one. You know, they, you know, it's the big red hourglass, the classic red hourglass, and they like to be on the north side of my house, which is protected from the sun. Mm-hmm. And they're in the flower garden. They like the corners. And actually, if you're not careful, they'll feel you coming and hide. You can't, you know, they'll run away quickly. But, you know, I'm just, if kids come over or whatever, I'm worried about that.
Sure. Well, yeah, you know, and so then I think dealing with them as you see them is probably the best thing you can do. And still, though, as I said, as you've noticed, their behavior is to go away from people, not go towards people. And I was teased when I was a young entomologist. I was told that all the old records for black widow bites in Wisconsin were basically when we had outdoor plumbing and people would sit down on them in the outhouse, which is a kind of place. And so that's, if you look in hospital records, where most of the records we have historically come from. And as I said, now with not having those types of situations, people just don't come in the kind of exposure where they have a potential of getting bit.
Charlie, thank you so much for your call. And Phil, I saw a story in USA Today about brown recluse spider bites on the increase across the country, especially in the Midwest. They mentioned Kansas City. Are they a problem? Are you getting reports of this in Wisconsin this
summer?
Well,
recluse is not native to Wisconsin. I have seen three or four cases of it in my career where we know the populations were breeding in very isolated cases. You know, there's been a lot in the entomological literature for a number of years now of misdiagnosis with recluse bites. In the argument, there's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Rick Vetter, who's in University of Cal Riverside, who does a lot of stuff, and he's got a great website. If you want to go Rick Vetter, do a search, and go to his website to get really the kind of the truth about recluse. And he was pointing out that half the cases are diagnosed in states where the spider's not found. So there's a disconnect here. And what they found is a lot of this is bacterial infection, these staph infections that are causing similar types of symptoms. So you see where the diagnosis comes from. He'll also point out that he's worked with people who have had thousands of spiders on their property or in their home and they never get bit. There's also a discussion that people differ in their sensitivities, that some people can get bit and have very little reactions to it. So it's not something we worry about here. Again, I'm always cautious when I hear of a diagnosis of a recluse bite that there could be something else going on.
Phil Pelletieri is our guest, UW-Madison professor in entomology and works at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. And if you have a question, the number for you to call in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Robin in Portage next. Hello, Robin. What's on your mind today?
Oh, good morning. I have to go back to the gypsy moths. I discovered an activity towards the end of July that seemed odd to me, and I really don't know anything about gypsy moths, and you may have mentioned something before, but in my backyard I have several large oak trees, old oak trees, and one of them is well over 100 years old, and it's split in the middle at the base, but it still lived that way for several years. Anyway, at the end of July, we had a terrible thunderstorm and some branches came down. There's old, dead branches in the trees. And I noticed on that tree, on the over 100-year-old tree, hundreds of caterpillars, which I identified as the gypsy moth caterpillar. They were all dead. And they were all facing down the trunk of the tree.
Okay, that's a classic symptom of this fungus disease, this entomophaga that was very prevalent. And, you know, if they die in a V shape, it's usually because of a virus disease. And so that's a very good sign. But, you know, it doesn't mean you're totally out of the woods, because the question is, it doesn't take very high survival rates to give us high populations next year. And so, you know, one of the things that is done sometimes is an egg count. One of the other things, though, I think to keep in mind here is that in order to be serious to the health of the tree, it takes 2 years in succession of total leaf defoliation, total stripping. So first of all, if you didn't notice, you know, any real thinning of the tree, that tells me the populations weren't that high. And then secondly, now a lot of them appear to have died from the fungus disease. And so you've got some kind of lead time here. You know, now next year, if it looks like the worms are high and they're all healthy, then you start to get in one of these scenarios that you have to watch for the buildup repeatedly a couple years in a row that would cause some damage. So, you know they're in their neighborhood now, which isn't surprising because a lot of the central Wisconsin has had problems for 5 to 7 years at least. It does sound, again, that a lot of good things happened naturally with this fungus disease. And who knows, if we get another wet period next spring, we could have another major outbreak of this and it will further knock down the population.
Mm-hmm. If they laid eggs, where do they lay their eggs that I could be looking for them?
The eggs look like a piece of light tannish, almost velvet. They're kind of fuzzy looking, maybe the size of a quarter to a 50-cent piece. A lot of them will be on the crevices in bark of the tree. But what we also see, if you've got lawn furniture or a house or a garage next to it, you often get egg masses on those also. In fact, for people who have those, one of the things that we talk about as a control option is to scrape them off and put them in a bucket of soapy water. Or there is a soybean oil spray called Golden Natural Oil that you can spray on the egg masses, and it suffocates them. And you can use this soybean oil anytime from now until about the 15th of April next year. So that's what some people will do, is that they have high egg mass populations, they will treat the ones on the trunk with the soybean oil. And every egg mass you're taking out, you could be taking over 200 caterpillars out. So it's a very effective way of taking them out versus letting them hatch and run up in the tree. And then the difficulty of spraying a large tree is often an issue. So again, this treating egg masses is often a great way of knocking their numbers down. So I would look around, and as I said, they're really, once you've seen them, quite distinctive. Look in the crevices and the like on the trunk. And sometimes in things around that area to see if you see many of them. And when they really get going, it's just absolutely coating the trunks. I mean, you can find one every 3 or 4 inches is the kind of thing. And then when you multiply the sheer number of worms that are generated from it, you can see why the tree has trouble.
What is the color of the egg itself?
It's kind of a blondish tan to me.
And it's fuzzy, kind of oval-shaped?
Well, it's somewhat flattened. And again, about the size of a quarter to a 50-cent piece, depending on the size of the female. So as I said, it looks kind of like a piece of tan velvet. And then if you start to dig into it, you will see all these tiny little round eggs. But this brownish tan covering, this slightly fuzzy covering, is secreted by the female to protect the eggs.
And the soybean, what was that called again that you can treat that
with? The product is called Golden Natural Oil. And it's a soybean oil with a little bit of a surfactant that aids in the penetration of the egg mass.
And where is that found?
You can see it at garden stores. I'm sure Jung's has it. Some of the Madison stores have it. You can always even probably order it by the internet, too. I'm not so sure you'd find it at the average hardware store, because this is kind of a specialty product, and they wouldn't most likely carry it. But the larger garden store should.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Robin, thanks very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. And let's go on to, we just lost a caller there. Let's go to Wally in Sussex next. Hi, Wally.
Hi. I have a cure for Dutch elm disease that could probably be used for this ash tree borer also. With these elm trees that are around here, I had three of them that were three-quarters dead. The bark was removed from about three-quarters of the tree, and I did this process, and those three trees are all growing with bark all the way around the tree now, and they've given off seeds, and fresh elm trees are growing around my land here, too, now.
What is your process?
I plant comfrey plants around the tree, and that is a systemic, goes into the tree's system, and it must kill the Dutch elm bugs or whatever. If anybody would like to come out here, I got plenty of comfrey that anybody that would want to try it could have it even free in order to try and protect their ash trees from the borers or any other trees that might be infested with other insects.
Okay, well, Dutch elm disease is a fungus, and I just am not aware if that product has efficacy against the larvae of the ash borer. It would be interesting. A lot of natural oils do. As you say, part of the problem is getting it to it, and so is it really systemic? Is it really uptaken by the tree? I can pass that information on to my plant pathology colleagues. I mean, I'm not aware if they're they have seen trials on that or not, but it's an interesting observation.
I've called DNR, and I don't think the information goes to the top. I called the UW Agricultural Department, and they didn't seem to believe me or something. I don't know. But if anybody would come up here and take a look at these trees, they would be amazed. In fact, the last DNR fellow that came here looked at one of my elm trees, and he said, was it hit by lightning? I said, no, it wasn't hit by lightning. The bark was missing from around three-quarters of the tree, and it's grown all the way back around the whole tree. It looks like a tree has never been even hardly touched except for that little slit where it grew together.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Thanks, Wally. We appreciate hearing that information. And Phil will pass it along to his colleagues and see what becomes of it. Let's go to Rad next in Hazelhurst. Hi, Rad.
Hi, guys. I have a question that's kind of half for Scott and half for Phil. But I get a row.
Well, I do believe we've lost your signal, Rad. You'll have to call back. Thanks very much. John in Germantown, let's give you a chance. Go ahead.
Hi. With all the news, and it's finally happened, the Emerald Ash Borer has made it into Ozaukee, now Newburgh, up in Washington counties.
That's right.
I know that Phil is probably very acutely aware of what's going on and what measures are being taken. And the papers mentioned some new countermeasures that might be coming on the market. Could he just explain what's going on, and I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, there are a couple of insecticides that were not registered in Wisconsin because we didn't have the insect. And so now that we do have the critter, we would expect it. And in particular, one of the products called Triage is an injectable. You know, rather than putting it in the ground as a drench where we let the roots suck it up, they are putting this in. And what's interesting about it is some of the results out of Michigan suggest one treatment will last for 2 to 3 years. Now, again, this is going to have to be applied by an arborist. There's going to be a moderate expense involved, and so it's not something that we're going to be looking at for trees out in the woods. But for high-value ash trees, it will be one of three or four options as far as chemicals that can be applied to the tree. So it does look interesting, and I think the thing, again, that makes this product unique is one treatment lasts for more than 1 year, which most of the other products are either put on as a drench, maybe injected, last only for a year, or one of the other strategies that are used more in communities is sometimes there are foliar sprays that are put on to kill the adults when they're active. This is more typically done by city foresters and whatnot. And I, as I said, in our situation here, I don't think we really have a good enough handle yet. I'm sure we'll within a couple, 3 weeks, but right now it's a little preliminary to see which direction all this is going to go.
As I read the Milwaukee Sentinel, Journal Sentinel, it appeared that, as you say, 2 or 3 weeks and we'll get a state plan announced.
Well, there is a generalized plan that's been together for 2 or 3 years that the university and DNR and DADCAP and USDA have all been involved with kind of formulating, and it's changed. You know, I think one of the things that concerned people initially is the way this was addressed is potentially cutting every ash tree within a half a mile and clear cutting it is basically robbing the insect of food was the theory. Well, you know, one of the blessings of getting this later than some of the other states is you can see the results. And one of the things that is picked up is that it's so hard to really define where they are and where they're not. And if you can't do that, how can you do it? Plus the expenses involved. And so I don't think, you know, you don't take anything off the table, but that is a far less likely scenario. And so now, again, hopefully if it's a small enough area, you can remove the trees and try to be aggressive there and see where that goes. But not, as I said, at least in the short run, I don't envision that we're going to take every ash tree out of northern Ozaukee County and Washington County. I don't think that's both economically feasible and, again, biologically, we're going to have to look at it in a different way. I think ultimately what we're looking at is a slow the spread. You know, as I mentioned, you know, whether we can stop this infestation here or not is one question. But the second one is it's just a matter of time before we see this somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as I said, I think we're looking at more ways of managing it, of slowing this so that we can all adjust, have chance to put other kinds of trees in, those kind of decisions.
Phil Pelletieri is our guest. He's a UW-Madison professor in entomology at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. And we're happy to have him answering your questions today. Lynn is next from Appleton. Hi, Lynn.
Hello. How are you today?
Good, thanks.
I have a bug in the back. I don't know if it's a beetle. They are having little babies that are like all red. I believe they have six legs, and as they get to be an adult, they're more black with just a red stripe down its back.
Okay, you have an animal we call a box elder bug, and they feed on the seeds of box elder and silver maple, and really don't pose the tree any problem. Their big claim to fame, unfortunately, is in the fall of the year, the adults will try to get in your house to spend the winter rent-free. So they're a nuisance insect, as far as that goes. Now, typically, when we get real wet periods, they don't do well. When we get dry periods, they do, and that's because they're more normally controlled by a different fungus disease than we get on gypsy moth, but it's a similar story. And it started to get dry enough this fall that I guess I'm not surprised they're starting to pick up, because this is typically what we see is that we get dry August, we get more box elder bugs. But no concerns at all with any of your plant material. The big concern is if they start clustering on the house in September in particular. And the clustering is not a problem. It's just a question, can they squeeze in? If they can squeeze in, then you will see box elder bugs kind of crawling around all winter long to some degree or another.
Don't hurt anything, though? I mean...
No. Other than the seed of those plants. And, you know, box elder is usually considered a weed tree almost, and so nobody is really concerned about the loss of seed on it. You can kill the insects with soapy water. If they're clustering on things, there are also sprays that can be used. But again, I wouldn't worry about that until they start this congregation. And there's a chance, again, that the weather patterns will be such that they are not going to be in high numbers this fall. It's still a little early to tell. But if it continues to stay dry, I would be, it's more likely you're going to have problems.
Yeah, because they seem to be coming by my cement, you know, on the wall of the house. They'll crawl out of there.
Yeah.
Like underneath, you know, the wall of the outer house.
Well, they often hide in sheltered places at times, although, again, the behavior in the fall is they all cluster together, and then they try to squeeze into things, and they cluster in sunny areas. I mean, that's just what they're about. It's a little early for that to happen. You know, in a couple weeks, I think, you know, I usually think about the 1st of September is about the time they start thinking about getting ready for the winter. And the immature stages, the little red ones you talked about, are not capable of overwintering, so they're going to have to mature if they're going to be able to spend the winter.
Okay, great.
All right, Apple. Lynn, thank you so much for your call there in Appleton. And the number for you to call is 263-1890 in Madison, or toll-free at 800-642-1234. Phil, I believe I heard that the first case of West Nile virus was detected in Wisconsin this summer. What do you expect there?
Well, you know, West Nile for humans in particular is traditionally more of a late summer disease. We definitely know that our mosquito numbers in general are up, and the Culex mosquito, which is the one that is the main vector of West Nile, its numbers have not been unusually high, although, again, the conditions are such. I guess the one thing we're seeing is we're not getting the number of dead birds yet, which is kind of the canary in the coal mine for us, because birds are very susceptible to West Nile. So we have some of the conditions that would suggest we've got the moderate number of mosquitoes, but it doesn't appear there's a lot of virus running around in nature. And so we will get more human cases, that I'm sure of. But as far as having a major outbreak right now, it does not appear we're going to run into that.
Back to the phones we go, and to, is it Harry or Barry? Harry in Madison. Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon. If moths are nocturnal, why are they attracted to light?
Well, the theory is that some moths use the moon to orientate. So if you're flying and the moon's way up there and you're going at a 30-degree angle, you can fly in a straight direction. But a light source that's very close to them, of course, if you're flying at a 30-degree angle for it, what it causes you to do is a circle. So the theory generally is those moths that use the moon as a way of kind of getting a handle on where they are in the world and how to orientate, get very confused in the presence of light, are attracted to it, are drawn into it because of that.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Harry. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Bob in Oak Creek next. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I'm curious about household centipedes. They get to be about an inch and a half long. Do they bite people? Are they harmful?
Well, if you could catch one, and that's a real big if, because as you notice, you turn the light on, and they run like the dickens to get away from you. They are capable of biting. It probably is less of an issue than even a bee sting would be. And I have yet to talk to somebody. I mean, I get them because they scare the devil out of people with all those gangly legs and whatnot. And and like, but I just don't talk to anybody that seems to get bit by them. And I think, again, it's the issue that their behavior is to go the other way. You just can't catch up to them. They're not an aggressive beast. They're not coming after you. They're trying to get away in all cases.
Would they bother anybody while they're sleeping?
Wouldn't expect it. Now, if one was in your bedroom slipper and you put your foot in there, would they bite you? Probably. I think it's that kind of situation. But you know, typically they are searching for insects and other things to feed at night. So they're kind of like little lions out there searching and hunting all the time. And that does get them scurrying around. So it's not impossible. But, boy, I've yet to run in a case where I was real comfortable saying that, yes, somebody was bit by a centipede.
Okay. They might be good for catching mosquitoes at night, huh?
Well, I don't think they're looking more for little beetles and ants and that kind of stuff. Because they can't fly, I think a mosquito generally would have a pretty good chance of getting away.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, Bob. Thanks very much. We appreciate your call. The number for you in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234 as we talk about the insect kingdom. Elizabeth in Fish Creek is next. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi. Well, your timing is perfect. We've been spending the morning trying to identify the most elegant, beautiful spider that my son found in the front yard. It is black and yellow, and it's more than 2 inches across from leg to leg, maybe somewhere between 2 and 3. And it just it's black with some brown on some of its legs, maybe 4 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it is sitting, its web is very, very light with the exception of what looks like a zipper. It's
sure.
A zigzag, and it's sitting on it, and it's just been sitting there for hours, and there's apparently another little creature crawling on it. So any thoughts?
Well, I think it is what we call the black and yellow garden spider. The genus is Argiope, A-R-G-I-O-P-E. If you do a search on that, you'll get lots of neat pictures. Common in the late summer, harmless to people. Not so good if you're a fly because they're very good at with that orb web of catching their prey. Males are quite a bit smaller than the females. I'm guessing you have a female there, and she will continue to try to prosper. Will lay an egg sac sometime late this fall, and that's how the spider gets through the winter, and they hatch into little baby spiders next spring.
Thank you. It's beautiful.
All right. Elizabeth, thank you very much for the call. And let's go to Rosa next in Milwaukee. Hello, Rosa.
Hi. I have a question. My boyfriend was fishing over in Viroqua about last summer, I think, and he got bit by something, I believe, and there it was in the corner of his hand between his thumb and his finger, and it turned into a huge blister. It was probably the size of a quarter or a little bit bigger, and it got up to like an inch off of his hand. And I was wondering if it was a spider bite or maybe something else.
Well, two thoughts. You always wonder in these cases if the complication is a secondary infection. And so there's no way of telling unless somebody were to do a plating and see what's there. Spider bites, and the way I explain it to people, I mean, it's hard to get spiders biting, but spiders do have venom that is used to digest their prey out of body. And so then they suck in the liquids. And so these are enzymes that are really, if they're getting in association with tissue, can cause localized damage. But so can assassin bugs and other insect predators. I mean, this is kind of a common trait for insects that eat other insects or spiders that eat insects, is to have some pretty interesting enzymes in their venom. And so it's usually not something you worry about as being a systemic body problem, but if you get enough of this venom in the right spot in your person, you can expect some problems. So, you know, it's so hard to diagnose bites by how they present. But spider bite is a possibility, and assassin bug is a possibility. There are other things, ambush bugs. I can think of, you know, half a dozen insects that potentially have venoms that could do that. But as I said, I also can't rule out that he didn't have a secondary infection, that it was a cut, or even, I mean, that's one of the questions about spider bites in some cases, is if they even do bite, is there a chance that that wound is opening up and allowing some kind of other infection coming in? So.
Oh, okay. right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. Our guest is Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison professor in entomology at the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the Madison campus, as we talk about the insect kingdom here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, Jim Packard sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about insects with Phil Pelletieri. And we go back to the phone to Chris in White Lake. Hello, Chris.
Hello. How are you gentlemen doing?
Good.
That's good. I have a question about Lyme disease. About 6 months ago, I was diagnosed with Lyme disease using the Western blot method of diagnostic. And I guess basically my question is, how often should I be rechecked? Should I be rechecked? And what is the outcome if I'm not rechecked?
Well, I'm not a physician, so I have to be a little cautious here. I guess the way I approach it, I mean, there's a couple issues here, is that the spirochete that you have in your system, if you're treated and whatnot, and you go symptom-free, one of the questions is it all out of your system or not? And nobody can answer that question because there's no test. Even if they look at your blood, you can't find the spirochete. I guess I would look at it a different way, that if you're having the symptoms, whether you're having the arthritic type problems, you're getting the rash, you're having, in some cases, neurological issues associated with Lyme, it's worth consulting the physician to track to see, indeed, is this a complication of that initial case? Typically, though, if you are exposed to Lyme again, it's going to start in the same pattern that it's supposed to, is that you get a fever, you get a rash. That's the initial symptoms where the spirochete is associated close to the tick bite. And so it's all on symptoms, as far as I could suggest to you, is if you start to get symptoms, it's worth it. If not, the blood tests, you know, it's reading antibodies, you know, and antibodies is your body reacting to what's there. Is it new stuff, old stuff? You know, I know the tests keep getting better, but we still, I don't think, have the kind of blood test that tells us everything we would really like to know about what's going on.
Yeah. Okay, well, I guess I'll just do some more research.
All right.
And thank you for your time.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you for listening and for calling. And let's go to Ronald in Madison. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Good. Interesting talk. We used to live up in the UP, and we're, you know, a lot of bugs up there. But we live in Madison now, about a block off Lake Monona. We live in an old house, and we've been gone for about 4 weeks. And we have a back, and it's like a sun porch, but the house was added on by an older man who used to live here. And I came back, and there was a ton of spiders in here.
Mm-hmm.
And they all live, like, in the corners. There's a lot of little nooks and crannies. And they're all the same kind of spider. And they definitely have killing zones. You can see lots and lots of bugs. And they've been getting in the house a little bit. And I have three small children, and they're terrified of spiders. And I don't really mind them too much. I mean, I don't mind our bats either because they eat bugs. But I bought some Ortho Home Defense that says it works for 12 months. Is that toxic, or is there anything I should be worried about if I spray my porch and spray on, you know, along the baseboards and under my daughter's crib and stuff?
Sure. Well, a couple things. To be honest, I think in the short run you can be as effective against spiders with a shop vac than you can with a spray. And the 12 months is kind of, you know, it definitely isn't going to hold up that long outside. If it holds up 3 weeks, that's kind of okay, but nothing more than that. Indoors, possibly, where you're protected from UV light. In general, for something like this, because the chance of a spider causing a complication is so small, and if you had young ones in, and we're always concerned that children are more sensitive to pesticides than adults, even though the label allows it and whatnot, I guess I just can't see the risk-benefit here of spraying the child's bedroom for a problem that is so remote. I don't think it's worth that. Now, again, if the kids are afraid of it, I can see spraying that outside and to try to help knock it down. But I'd still, again, would contend that about once every 2 months going out there with a shop vac and getting back in the corners is going to be as effective. Another thing why you probably have more intense spider issues than people that might live away from the lake, I'm guessing that when you were gone, you had some kind of security lighting on in the back. Well, you know, there's so many insects that come off water that are attracted to light. And so, you know, you get this all the time right next to the lakeshore. People have tremendous spider populations on the outside of their house. And part of what it is when the lights are on, you're drawing all these insects in there, that spider food. The spiders know how to take advantage of that situation. So you are always going to be more prone. But you can look at least in some cases with the security lighting, going to some of the yellow lights and other things that are less attractive to insects, with a theory that you bring less insects into the yard, which means there'll be less food for the spiders. So that's another adjustment that you can make that might help things out somewhat.
The other thing is we have a bunch of old aluminum awnings in the front of the house, and mm-hmm. there's a ton of wasp nests up there, and they don't bother me either. Is it necessary to kill them, or can I just leave them be? One gets in the house every week or two.
Yeah, same kind of thing. Wasp nests, the biggest concern is if they are threatened, bumped, you know, if they're in an area that's high traffic, then the wasps become very defensive, and the likelihood of getting stung goes way up. And generally speaking, wasp issues intensify when we get to late summer and early fall just because their colonies are bigger. But if you went this far without much of a problem, and again, the awnings are up high enough that the kids aren't, you know, 2 feet away from when they come in and out of the door, I don't think there's any need to bother with them. You can make the argument some of these wasps are collecting caterpillars, including gypsy moths, so they have some beneficial sides to their biology, too. It's just that when we get them in a place where there's a lot of people or pet traffic, then again, because of the likelihood of them being disturbed, then we have to deal with them. And you know, normally these wasp sprays that are sold work very well, but the recommendation would be wait till 7 or 8 o'clock at night when everybody's at home. It's not good to spray them in the middle of the day because the workers that are not there will come back. They will get quite agitated, and they might cause some problems for a few days.
Uh-huh. Well, listen, I appreciate it. Yeah, because I don't like killing the bugs. I think they're beneficial. I don't want – my wife wants me to remove the bats from the old chimney that's sealed up. I like them there.
Sounds like the shop vac is the way to go.
All right. Thanks, man.
All right. Ronald, thanks very much for your call. And again, if you'd like to join in, the number in Madison is 263-1890 or toll-free at 800-642-1234. Mark is next in Green Bay. Hi, Mark.
Yes, I'm a beekeeper, and I was wondering if there's any more information on a CCD for honeybees.
Oh, boy, still a big hot topic. You know, I think the consensus is, although there are people that don't agree, that this Israeli acute virus is at least a part of the story that's going on. Still seems to be not a big issue in Wisconsin overall. Still seems to be a major issue with the migratory beekeepers. And as I said, as the research keeps coming out, you know, one of the arguments is this virus was present a few years before we started to see what we now call colony collapse disorder, at least at the level that we're seeing it. And so those are the people that argue. But other people say, well, it's a different strain of the virus. And so they said, of all the things that have been looked at, that one seems to have enough of a pattern that makes sense of where we see the disease or not. So, but I don't think anybody would tell you we've got this all nailed down. It's going to be a complex of things. You know, much like we talk to people, that the stress that's involved with migratory beekeepers seems to be a major component here of allowing this thing to kind of kick in. Whereas when you talk to people that are hobbyists and whatnot, they're not having the problems. And the other side of it, too, is that there's confusion here, because we know that the varroa mites have continued to cause people major headaches. The varroa mite is part of the actor here in transmitting the virus. And, you know, from what I've seen, still the bee losses in Wisconsin are more a management issue, or in particular the problems people are having controlling the varroa mite.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, Mark, good luck to you. Thanks very much for your call. And let's get Mary in before the news. Hello, Mary.
Hi. I found an unusual-looking caterpillar, or a moth, I believe it was a moth, over the weekend. And what drew my attention, I thought it was a piece of birch bark stuck to the side of my air conditioner unit. And there was an orange fuzzy, about an inch and a half thing, right next to it. And when I looked closer, I realized it was a moth, and that was an egg sac. Wondered if you could identify from that feeble description
would have to see the picture, to be honest, because there's so many moths that are camouflaged like bark or bird droppings in particular. I mean, we're talking well over 100 in the state. And but if I saw the picture of the pupal case that you saw and whatnot, which may still be attached, I have a couple suspicions. It's a tussock moth, just because the females of some of those, and the males too, also the females are wingless, but they just have a very characteristic type of cocoon and pupal case.
This wasn't newly hatched. This was a female, I suspect, had just laid the eggs.
Okay, well, then the same thing. I mean, it may
sure, be. And I did take a picture. I'm not sure how it turned out, but where can I send that to you?
Okay, well, you know, if you've got it in a digital picture, you can email it to me. And my email address is PELL, I-T-T-E, at entomology, E-N-T-O-M-O-L-O-G-Y, dot W-I-S-C for Wisconsin, dot E-D-U for education.
Great. Okay, I will send that to you.
All okay. right, Mary, good luck to you. Thanks very much for the call. That is usually the way in which you can actually make a diagnosis
well,
here.
You know, it's so interesting, you know, being one of these old guys. I tell people the digital camera was the greatest invention in my career, I think, because both allowing me to take pictures of things that, you know, may be difficult. But right now, about 40% of what I'm processing in the lab are digital images that people take rather than seeing samples. And, you know, if you take a picture in your backyard and I'm lucky enough to get at it that morning, I can give you an immediate answer. Whereas, you know, the males, I can only tell you what the mail trucks do to some of these things that come in there. They get crushed and whatnot. And, you know, part of it's the way they're packaged and stuff. So usually if you got a good picture, boy, that's a great way of working things. Once in a while, it doesn't have the detail, and I'll have to ask you to see the sample. But it's, again, a very quick way, I think, of turning a lot of these questions around.
And briefly, do caterpillars, the gypsy moth caterpillar, do they prefer any particular tree leaves to eat on, or are they equal opportunity eaters?
Oak.
They love oak.
They'll feed on poplar and other things, but we worry about them. Oak is where it starts. They'll spill over to apple and purple leaf plum and crabs, a number of things. But when we tend to see them build, oak is where we start looking.
And we'll talk more about bugs, insects with Phil Pelletieri after the news. He is a UW-Madison professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and glad to have you along with us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk about insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. I know I've asked you this question in the past, Phil, but I saw it again. What's going on when you have a swarm of insects along the cracks of the pavement where a section of sidewalk, let's say, meets another? All of a sudden, you've got all of this activity. These little insects are just going crazy down there.
In that scenario, I mean, swarms are often collections of insects, and we've got flies that swarm and dragonflies that even swarm, but that one's got to be ants. And we're coming up to the time. Different ants swarm at different seasons, and once we get into late August and early September, both the cornfield ants, the field ants, and potentially the pavement ants will swarm. And so you'll often see the phenomena in late afternoon. All of a sudden, you know, you're walking the sidewalk 2 hours ago and there's nothing there. And all of a sudden, this explosion of winged ants. And they will fly off with the idea that they're both what we would call kings and queens, the reproductive males and females. And they're supposed to find a member of some other colony to mate with so that we get some gene flow here. And so the swarming in an area is often kind of a phenomena that most ant colonies are swarming of the same species swarming at the same time. And as I said, in particular, coming out of your yard, the little cornfield ants, the big mound ants, the big field ants that we get will be swarming quite typically in the late afternoons. On sunny days, you don't see much activity on a cloudy day. Sometimes some swarms are triggered by rains. Just depends on the ant species.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing to be worried about. But, you see cases where there's just literally millions of ants coming off, and often you see a lot of birds taking advantage of this. You'll get flocks of birds up there picking these off, and in particular, these large females make great food because they're so packed with protein and whatnot, because they have to carry all this protein with them to be able to produce eggs and all the things that they need to do.
All right, let's go to the phones again, and we'll go to Mike and Amory. And Mike, what's on your mind today?
Yes, I have a question about the Asian beetles. For many years, I live in northwestern Wisconsin, just outside the city of Amory, on a more or less a 7-acre hobby farm. And for many years, I'd say at least the last 7 or 8 years, especially in the fall, I've had a horrible infestation of these Asian beetles. But they seem to have been tapering off for the last, maybe 2 or 3 years. They don't seem to be as bad as they were five or six years ago. And my question is what... what does it look like for the future of the Asian beetle? Is it going to get any better than it has been?
Well,
that fluctuation in the numbers of them each year.
Well, you have to look at the history of that insect is only about 12 to 14 years that it's been in the state. And I guess my first take on it is we often observe with invasive insects that they are the most out of whack the first few years they get there, and then they come into a little bit more of a balance. Because I've basically seen the same thing you have, is that overall the numbers of Asian lady beetles are, relatively speaking, down in the last 3 or 4 years. But that, as I always warn people, is relative. I can tell you they're down by 60%. And so instead of having 100,000 in your house, you've got 40,000. That's still too many. So they're still causing problems. I will tell you that we are not seeing a lot of them out in the soybean fields right now, compared to what we'd see. So if I had to give you an early prediction, and I always get in trouble when I do this, but I would say that also this year I expect the numbers to be somewhat down. We're just not seeing the evidence of high populations that we sometimes see at this time of the year, because they do feed, they feed on aphids in trees in a lot of places, but they do like to feed on soybean aphids.
Okay, great. Thank you
very
much.
All right, Mike, thanks very much. We appreciate your call. And let's go on to Don, who's in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Don. What's going on?
Good afternoon. This summer, my house was invaded by some small insects, which I've been told are springtails. I've tried several commercial exterminators, but they don't seem to know how to get rid of them. I've tried at least three, and I still have the bugs.
Tell me a little bit about the house. New house, old house?
Old house. It's about 30 years old.
Okay, and were you having springtail problems before this?
No. What happened is I planted some grass in the left side of my yard, and I used sphagnum peat moss to cover the seed, and I watered it quite a bit, and that's where they seem to come from that side of the house, and that's at least that's where they started from in that side of the house, and they've worked their way through the house. So I think that's how they started, is I believe they were in the sphagnum peat moss that I bought.
Well, you know, springtails, if you were to ask somebody who works in prairies and whatnot, are the most dominant life form in the soil as far as insects are concerned. So they feed on the organic matter, and when they come out in March, we call them snow fleas, so you can see them at any time of the year. But when I think of springtails, the first thing I think of is relatively high moisture levels, because they're very sensitive to drying out. And secondly, some source of organic matter. And although I've seen cases where they were breeding in a house because we had a leak in a wall or some other thing that would create the right environment, more often than not, the problem is the springtails are blossoming out of the ground and then coming into the house by accident, but it's a constant invasion. Now, I definitely get more of these kind of calls in new constructions where we went into a forest or other place, even an old ag field that had a lot of organic matter. We've disturbed the soil, planted it in, so the springtails are just kind of getting up and I think looking for greener pastures. And often that will settle down over time. I do think you're probably correct that the sphagnum, even if it wasn't the source of the springtails, it's given them a source of organic matter, plus you're watering this, so you've created the kind of environment they would thrive in. I think indoors, for sure, you will see the things drop off once we get in the heating season because the house dries out so much, it's all of a sudden a very hostile environment. Outdoors, I don't know what they've tried. Usually what people will attempt to do to help it out is to power spray, to use a relatively large volume of product sprayed on the lawn to try to knock the numbers down. But I'll tell you, it doesn't work in all cases. It really has a lot to do, again, of where they're coming from and what are the conditions. The thing, though, because it's an older property, I can't assume this is going to be a continuous problem. I think it's going to run its course, whether you do something or not with it. And it would be helpful if I knew what chemicals the people used and how they applied it. Did anybody come in and use, again, rather large volume sprays, or did they just use the little handheld sprayer when they came to your house?
No, I did have one that came and used a large volume of spray.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to remember exactly what that spray was right now.
Okay, I'm sure it's either one of the pyrethroids, you know, and the names that they use are different than what you'd see at the garden store. Did that at least give you some temporary help?
It did. They did seem to kind of die off for a little while, and then they came back again.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, I've noticed that all summer long, even if I don't do anything, sometimes they seem to kind of go away, and then they come back again.
Yeah, and I'm guessing it may have either to do with general humidity levels or even just general moisture levels. You know, after rains, I expect them to pick up. If you got an extended dry spell, I don't expect them to come out of the ground because, as they said, that's not going to be a good place for them. So he said, I think things will settle down. It honestly may be as much advice rather than throwing more money at this is you could probably do almost as good a job by getting one of these hose end attachments and buying a garden insecticide and spraying it in those areas that are giving you trouble. In particular, you look for things like the bifenthrins and the permethrins and the lambda cyhalothrins, so, you know, the bug begones and whatnot. and you'd be doing a similar type of treatment. Indoors, I don't think I'd spray with them. Again, I would see what I could do to dry things out. Sometimes a fan might be your best friend in the basement, in this case, or a dehumidifier. And as I said, I'm guessing their days are numbered, both because the coolness that's coming in will lower insect activity. And then again, once we get into the heating season in the house, if you were to tell me you consistently still saw springtails in November in your house, then again, we'd start be looking at leaks in walls and attics and something else, because that's an unnatural situation. Again, I think, unfortunately, you're just inheriting the springtails that are out in your lawn by accident in the house.
Okay. All right. Just one last question. If they go away for the winter, do you think the chances are they'll come back in the spring? Or?
Well, I'm guessing not, unless you used a tremendous amount of sphagnum. And in normally, even if, you put peat and other things in the ground like people often do to prepare flower beds, I don't necessarily associate that with springtails. So I guess, going back in historically, is you've only seen them once in 30 years type of thing, or at least while you've been in the house, I would be surprised if they came back in numbers. I don't think you're going to get the environmental conditions set up the same way again. And for that reason, I wouldn't expect them.
All right, thanks a lot, Phil.
All right, Don, thank you. Thank you for your call. The number for you in Madison is 263-1890 or toll-free at 800-642-1234 as we talk with Phil Pelletieri about the insect kingdom. Teresa in Mayville is next. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I have a question about a bug that we found under our tree bark. The people that owned the house before us had like a squirrel feeder that was made out of wood that was on the tree. So my husband and I went to go take it off. And these longer bugs with these pincers on them, which someone told us were earwigs, were completely everywhere. And he kind of pulled up the bark on the tree and they're just all over the place. And some of the bark is kind of falling off. And we don't know if it's going to end up killing the tree or if we just leave them alone.
Well, they're there because there's something else going on. A healthy tree doesn't support earwigs under the bark. When things kill the tissue underneath it and you've got loose bark, that's a great place for earwigs to congregate. So they're just hanging out because of the environment and don't pose a threat to the tree health at all. The other side of it, though, is that there's a lot of bark sloughing off. That's not a good sign as far as what's going on for the tree. So they're really two separate things to look at. It may be just as innocent as there's just one little bad patch here. The tree's going to heal it over and there's nothing to worry about. But as I said, the earwigs are more taking advantage of what's there. They're not the cause of it.
I see.
So you'd probably want to have an arborist take a look at that.
Well, is the general tree, what percentage of the bark is falling off and is in bad shape?
It just seems to be one location.
Okay.
It's kind of maybe 4 or 5 feet off the ground, and it's just in one area.
Okay. Well, it may even be that when he hung the squirrel feeder and whatnot, they did, it's like getting a cut on us is it opens up a potential infection site. And so that may have started this problem. As long as you're not seeing dieback in the upper portion of the tree and you're not seeing this area spread, I don't think there's a need to call anybody. You can just, it should heal over. As I said, if it continues to progress, then I think, if you're worrying about the health of the tree, then I think you need an arborist to come in and assess what's going on and if there's something that could be done.
Okay.
All right, Teresa. Thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. And let's go to Charles next in Sun Prairie. Hi, Charles.
Hi. I'm appreciating your show.
Good.
Thank you for your guest for being on. I have a question, actually, in regard to mosquito repellent on children. I've read a variety of different, sometimes conflicting material. Is a product with DEET really the answer to go, or are there other products that might be less harmful to be using on smaller children?
Well, there are definitely a number of alternatives, and far more now than there was 10 years ago. I think DEET, the argument is made that there have been billions of dosages of DEET put on people. With very little effect. Where there has been concern is when people have in some cases overdosed, and again, very young children. You'll see some of the recommendations to keep, DEET off of kids under the age of 2. Some of the problems too with young ones is if they have stuff on their skin, they were tending to lick and other things, and so they're getting exposures in ways that older people and kids and adults don't have. But as I said, there are definitely options. There are some natural plant oil options. There's eucalyptus oil out there. And if you look at the comparison of the efficacy, how well it works, a lot of these products out from anywhere from 20 minutes to 2 hours are everybody as good as DEET, where they start to lose their strength is longer protection. But that's always a question with anything. You know, if you've got kids that are very active, no matter what you put on them, they're sweating it off. And so I think that the recommendations, if the kids are old enough to have DEET, the difference between a 20% DEET and 100% DEET as far as how long it keeps mosquitoes off, you'd say, well, if it's five times stronger, it should keep them five times as long. It's not even close to that. And so for that reason, in most cases, if you're not under extreme conditions, people are saying going with the milder formulations, if you are using DEET, are the way to go. And again, put as much on clothing and not as skin. I mean, there are just some practical things that you get less exposure. The concern with the product is a small amount of is absorbed. So again, if you're using less concentrated stuff, you're getting less product absorbed. The less you put on your skin, the less that's being absorbed. And again, when you're really getting into infants and whatnot, you should look at other ways, I think, of, you know, screening their play areas or even their strollers or whatnot. You can put little screens over them and whatnot rather than putting product on. But as I said, these eucalyptus oils and whatnot are products that really work very well. There's a soybean oil product called Bite Blocker out there that really in for an hour or so is a pretty good product. And again, soybean oil traditionally doesn't give us a lot of toxicity issues. So I definitely think if you do a little bit of homework and look it around, there are options there. Now, I get a little nervous about some of the natural options. You know, some of the natural plant oils that have some repellency can cause burns and whatnot. And, you know, I always tell people that natural, you know, means that it exists in nature without being synthetically produced, but it doesn't mean it's safe. I think this association, if it's natural, it has to be safe. Like any chemical, they have their own personalities. You have to learn, you know, what their strengths and weaknesses and potential problems are. But at least these eucalyptus oils and other things that are registered with Food and Drug and whatnot have been tested enough. I'm very comfortable with them. Some of these natural remedies and whatnot, that's where I start to get a little concerned.
Great. Well, thanks for your great work.
Okay, Charles, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. Mike is next in Cushing. Hello, Mike. What's on your mind today?
I have some spruce trees, and I'm not sure if it's an insect problem or it's a disease problem, but the very tip of the tree, the top, the leader sort of turns brown, and then a couple of branches underneath it have turned brown and curl over. Now, I don't know whether they've been broken off by birds or if they're... Okay. If they're an insect that causes this.
How big are the trees?
Oh, they're probably 15 feet tall, probably 12 years old.
There is a white pine weevil that can cause those kind of symptoms. Now, you know, if the stuff is browning and dying, you're probably going to have to prune it and try to retrain the tree anyway. But when you do prune this dead stuff off, take a pen knife or a box cutter and scrape back the bark a little bit. If it is white pine weevil, you'll see these roundish, in almost stringy sawdust-like material. It's called a chip cocoon, and it's the pupal case of these weevils. And usually you'll get a number of these lined up inside that leader. And that's traditionally what white pine weevil does, is it attacks the leader and kills it. So as I said, with a little investigating, I think you can kind of sort through. And if it is, there are some remedies that can be done. If you don't see that, you know, then we start looking. And My guess is if it's white pine weevil, that's all that's going to happen. If the plant continues to decline and show dieback, then there's something else going on.
Does this white pine weevil then attack the spruce trees?
Believe it or not, it's not. I see it a lot more on pine than spruce, but I have seen white pine weevil on spruce, yes.
Okay.
All right, Mike. Good luck to you. And check in on Garden Talk sometime. Maybe they'll have an answer for you there as well once you see any decline in your tree. William in Colfax, let's go to you next. Hi.
Hi. I was just out in the garden, and I saw something that was on the phlox. It was like feeding like a hummingbird does, only it's not a hummingbird. It's an insect of some kind. Do you know what that is? It's like green and has burgundy wings and...
Well, my guess is it's what we would call a hawk or sphinx moth, and there are a number of different species in the state, and they are hummingbird-like in the way they feed, the way they flutter, except they've got this long proboscis that they use to feed on the flowers. I don't know which one it is without seeing a little bit more detail, but again, if you do a search on the internet under hawk moth or sphinx moth, you'll see a number of different species, and then it's just a question if you got a good enough look at the color patterns on the wing to tell you which species it is. The immature stage of these are often referred to as hornworms, although they don't all have horns. Some of them have eye spots and other markings, but they usually are pretty impressive caterpillars, up to 3 inches in length, and then they burrow in the ground to do their transformation, and then these adults come out. And I mean, the adults, again, mimic hummingbirds in the way they kind of dart back and forth and are very quick flyers when they need to fly.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right, William. Good luck to you. Thanks very much for your call. Danny's in Lake Geneva. He's next. Hi, Danny.
Hi, how you guys doing? Yeah, I usually start my vegetable crop right before the spring inside, and I had an issue with spider mites this year, and I like to approach it naturally if I can. And also, I was just curious, are they spiders or are they mites?
They're mites. They're mites, but at times they create webbing, and so that's where the name was derived. And there are different kinds of them. To be honest, insecticidal soap, which is a product that's sold, it's a fatty acid soap, is very effective against spider mites. You'll also get some relief, to be honest, just by plant misting. Mites don't do well under high humidities. They tend to do very well under hot, dry conditions. And so the water itself will wash some of the mites off. It also will create higher humidity, which is a hostile environment to them. But if you needed it, become more aggressive. As they said, insecticidal soap is a product that's registered for all kinds of vegetables and plants. It is not a whole lot different than the soap we wash our hands with, and it will kill the mites.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much. And let's see if we can get Kevin's question answered in La Crosse. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Back in the late 90s, I worked on the gypsy moth program for the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, and I was just kind of curious what kind of how much has things have changed in the last 10 years? Are they still using some of the same biological controls, using the BT and things like that? And the other thing I was wondering about is there another gypsy moth, like an Asian gypsy moth, that I know the Eurasian, the female doesn't fly. It just goes from tree to tree on a strand of thread. Now, is there another one that the female can fly?
Yeah, the Asian gypsy moth is basically a variety of gypsy moth that has flight in the females. There have been populations picked up on the West Coast, but they've been very aggressive. And as far as I know, I don't know if we have an established population of the Asian gypsy moth in the United States right now. And the fear with that one is because it can fly, it can spread so much quicker. And so that's why they were so aggressive. Yes, still similar things. The BTKs, or in some cases, they use some pheromone flakes in sensitive environments to try to slow and disrupt the gypsy moths. The spread continues to move westward in the state, and so that the fire line or whatnot, the treatment line really has moved quite a bit west. It used to be between Stevens Point, Madison, and Janesville. Now it has moved west of us as they're trying to stop the movement. But again, to me, the most significant thing that in the last 10 years is this fungus disease that has kicked in that, under the right conditions, has had more impact than anything else we've tried. And the only problem with it needs certain weather conditions. And we know we won't get those every year, but we don't need it every year. As I said, and this is really what the whole slow the spread program was about, is to try to prevent it from moving any faster than it could, with the hope that something would come in that could make a significant difference. And I definitely say this entomophaga fungus has made a significant difference.
Okay, great. Just one last quick question. I know 10 years ago they said that I'd never be able to completely eradicate the gypsy moths. Now, in 10 years, has that changed at all?
No. In fact, of anything you would say, it's continued to spread. It's just that I think that's the concern in most of the states. There's no such thing as eradication. There's just way too big of an area that's infested. We don't have anything that's 100% effective under any circumstances. And so, as I said, it's more of a managing type of thing than expecting we're going to eradicate it.
And if you've got further questions about gypsy moth, the hotline in the state of Wisconsin is 1-800-642-MOTH. Phil, thank you so much for being here today. We look forward to seeing you in another appearance.
Sounds good, Jim.
And I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of the calls today. We'll invite you to call back in a month or so when Phil Pelletieri returns, UW-Madison professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. Coming up tomorrow, home renovation and repair issues with Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction in Madison and John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates of Fitchburg. Our thanks to Brittany DeAnda today for on-air phone production. I'm Jim Packard. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.